So what I'm going to talk about is a little bit different. Like, I'm not going to spend an hour teaching you functional reactive programming because you can't learn that in an hour. There's so many different things to learn. I am going to talk about ways to learn and some of the basic principles. But what I really want to do is help people understand what is the shift, why is the shift happening, give a tour of the shift in progress, and talk about some of the technology and do a bit of a tutorial. And then, you know, answer the question, can I make the shift or can my team make the shift, and should we make the shift? And those last two questions are unanswered, and there's a lot of wheel spinning happening, especially with Angular 2 coming out. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So I was at Angular Connect, and I've been to a number of React conferences. And with Angular 2, there's an interesting sort of aspect to the architecture. You can go with sort of a React-type component architecture that's more functional, more reactive. They're using RxJS, which is a functional sort of a reactive library. To build your apps, or you can go with like the classic Angular 1 MVC model view controller that people are used to. So if you're starting a new project and you're building a project, one of the questions is with Angular 2, should I use a reactive architecture or should I use a classic MVC architecture? And that's a really good question, and I've asked a ton of people that question. I've asked people from Facebook, people from the Angular team. I've asked people from Netflix. And the answer was always, it depends, and we're not really sure. And so that's not a very good answer, because if it's like, use what you feel like, that's not really a great way to make a business decision. You know, software and code has a lot of economic value. We're basing our business on it. So, you know, what should we do for building out an application? That's the quick answer. Generally, our answer at Wrangle is yes. You should use functional reactive approaches, and we've done it on about a dozen projects now. We've done it with Angular 1, we've done it with Angular 2, we've done it with React, we've done it with, you know, homegrown sort of libraries. And the reason for yes is sort of interesting. But first, let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit about what is the shift. You know, what is functional reactive programming? I mean, it's sort of a whole new thing. It's actually not that much. Fundamentally, it's about functions and functional composition. And the number one recommendation I can make to people, if you want to use a functional reactive approach to building applications, get the functional down first. Understand reducers and understand functional composition. And, you know, learn how to build an application using immutable data structures. And then you can start to consume streams, and you can then drive your updates based upon those streams. If you try to use streams, which is just a flow of data, so rather than fetching data discreetly and getting packets, you're just listening and subscribing to a stream of data. If you're trying to manage streams without using a functional approach, the actual figuring out of what's being updated, how it's updated, and driving that logic gets extremely complicated. And we'll talk a little more about that later. So you have streams. It's similar to like a pipe on Unix. It's similar to PubSub. It's not really that different. The main thing is the functional aspects of it and diving deeper into that. And then there's the reactive patterns of update, like Meteor or RxJS, where you're making a change on the server and it's being reflected automatically into the client. You don't have to do the call to the server. You don't have to think about the plumbing. That's a great sort of concept, but is it that important for your type of app? And we'll talk a little more about that later as well. But, you know, what is it in practice? We had one massive functional reactive project, and it actually almost drove a couple of our developers like mildly insane. It was unfortunate, but it was a very complex architecture. It was too ambitious. The architecture didn't really fit the domain, and there was just too much going on. Halfway through the project, this was with a client. Yeah, we were brought on to help get them to market faster. Halfway through the project, there was a rethinking of the architecture, and we drastically simplified it. And onboarding for new developers onto the project went from 2 weeks to essentially 2 days. It was a massive shift. But it's a new way of thinking. It's a new way of composing applications. It's a new set of tools. That also brings a profound sense of discomfort. And, you know, it's an agenda pushed by a self-selected group of enthusiasts, right? I mean, functional programming has always been like this sort of interesting group. It was academia with Haskell. It was Scala, the Clojure people. And the people who are really excited about it are really excited about it because they're really excited about it. It's really cool. It's an interesting way of building applications. It gives them a sense of expressiveness, but that doesn't mean that it makes a great business sense. It doesn't mean that it's going to scale to a large team of developers. It doesn't mean that your classic object-oriented trained developers are going to adopt it and do it well. It is a significant change, and we'll talk a little more about that. And, you know, most importantly, it's a whole new set of ways to crash and burn on projects. And I say this in with love in my heart, but we've worked on a ton of Angular projects, and most Angular 1 projects that were written 2 years ago by today's standards are abhorrent. They're just horrible. They're just really, really awful because they just follow all these bad practices, because when you learn a new framework, when you learn a new way of building an application, the thing that's new is what you think the thing is, and you forget about things like modularity and clean code and software engineering and decoupling and isolating code and things that are just sort of basic software engineering practices. So I don't know, how many people here have done any work with Angular? Just, all right, so that's like almost half the crowd. And I mean, Angular is very cool. It has something called two-way data binding, which means that you can have a piece of data and it'll be reflected into your DOM, your HTML, and if you update it in the HTML, it's reflected back in your data, and you don't have to write a lot of this boilerplate. That's really cool. And there's controllers to do this. So early Angular applications are all about big controllers that are just manipulating these complex scope chains, and it becomes really awkward really quickly. It's not testable. It's hard to maintain. It's hard to reason about. It's hard to fix bugs. It's hard to maintain synchronicity across different parts of the application. And so Angular has evolved to the point where controllers are skinny, which Rails went through the same evolution from fat controllers to skinny controllers over like a 5-year period. Controllers are skinny. Scope is limited. There's a new controller as thing that came out. The fundamental way of building an Angular app today versus the 90% of the books, like the best practices, they're completely different. It's a remarkable evolution, but it's not an unexpected one. And you could see the same with Rails before that. You could see the same with Java. I worked in enterprise Java a long time ago, and everybody built these massive class hierarchies, and massive class hierarchies are very fragile, and they're not the best way to compose applications. So there was a shift from using class hierarchies to model Java applications to using object composition at runtime. It's more dynamic. So just these different patterns evolve over time, and you can build more resilient, better applications. So functional reactive programming is the same thing. So a quick tour. I mean, sort of talked about it already, but one of the big things is reactive extensions for JavaScript. This came from the .NET world. It's a reactive streams library for asynchronous data. You subscribe to things. Things are updated automatically, and you're not doing that sort of REST API call. There's a GraphQL from Facebook as well. Instead of a REST API, it mounts everything as a single sort of endpoint in your application. There's Falcor. And these things are really reflecting server-side state into the client application and dynamically updating it without you having to make calls and think about it. Now you have this stream concept, this reactive concept in the client, which is driving updates in the application. And now you have to think about maintaining state in the application and updating state based upon the changing data stream. And that's where the functional aspect of things come into play. And we'll do a tour of this a little bit later. One of the arguments you'll hear people talking about is, should we use observables versus promises? Observables are basically a reactive concept in JavaScript that are coming in later browsers, where you're observing something and you just get a notification when it changes. There's an interesting thing if you want to have some fun and think if you've done any React work. There's been this ongoing sort of challenge of trying to figure out the best way to integrate observables into React, and it's interesting if you really want to dive into the theory on that. We have a different opinion on that, which I'll get to. So I think an important question is, because functional programming has been knocking at the doors of industry for decades, and why is the shift happening now? And there are a number of reasons. JavaScript is one of them. It's a fantastic functional language, and with a few enhancements like ImmutableJS, you can actually start to do some interesting functional programming. That's enabling things like RxJS, Falcor, GraphQL, React, and those are bringing people slowly into the functional world, because as you work with React, you start thinking about immutability, you think about components, you think about state, and the biggest theme that I've heard in the last year in the JavaScript world is that our biggest problem is reasoning about state, and over time, reasoning about state is what we're trying to address. That's what React has really brought into the community from a thinking perspective. I've heard React described by a number of Facebook engineers working on it as a gateway drug to functional programming. It was their first introduction to functional programming, and it's what got them excited about it, and that's driving a lot of their move over. So what's driving the shift? Ultimately, I think there's quite a few things, but one of them is asynchronous data. and the promise callback architectures. This has been a big challenge in building large client-side applications, is mediating the data layer, talking to the back-end server. With Angular applications, initially everyone was just making calls and pulling data and running into synchronous issues. The Angular team had thought that through, and they integrated promises throughout Angular. And a promise is a way of encapsulating in a synchronous call that you're getting a promise of the data later. So it is somewhat reactive in some respects. This has always been a large problem. With Angular 1 and services and promises, you can actually compose quite complex applications and maintain sanity around your asynchronous data communication. However, debugging can be quite hellish, and you can run into some interesting sort of problems just trying to figure out what's happening in a complex promise architecture. Functional programming, JavaScript's quite functional. I think REST APIs actually invite a functional approach because you are always working with data structures. And one of the biggest anti-patterns I saw with early Angular developers 3 years ago was they would get a JSON data structure back from the server, and they would try to turn it into a object-oriented data model in the client and add a lot of extra sort of work to their job. As opposed to you already have a data structure that's already well-reasoned, you just need to transform it. And so using functions and using things like underscore and Lodash and Romdev became more and more popular. I think moving to HTML5 and building these large front-end applications with more complex user experiences has driven a lot of these problems. Like, we've never actually built large applications with JavaScript. I mean, that's just the reality of it. We're working within a page context. We're hacking away at it. And we can get some pretty amazing things done on our page by, searching Stack Overflow and cutting and pasting jQuery plugins and using that to style our page and do transitions and do cool stuff. We're not doing that anymore. We're building large code bases. We've got 30,000, 40,000 lines of code running in the browser. And it's just a different realm. We work with a lot of web developers. We're a web application development company. We hire a lot of intermediate developers and a lot of senior developers. And one of the most telling things is when people have worked on small teams on small applications, they don't know the world of pain that they're headed for. When they work on a large team that's distributed with large requirements that live over a long period of time, with shifting stakeholder impacts, things that are just going to whack the architecture. And, initially the reaction is like they get angry at the client because like the client keeps changing his mind. But it's not. Reality keeps shifting. We have to build resilient architectures. So we're building complex applications with complex architectural needs. We're doing it with JavaScript. We're doing it in the browser. This is a new thing, and it hurts, on large apps. I mean, you can spend some time, if you spend some time in the Angular world and you were trying to use root scope to try to share data across different panels, and then you tried to move to emit and broadcast, and you learned all the dysfunction of that, and, sort of diving in deeper into these large, complex sort of applications with complex state and reasoning about it, there's a reason that Angular is being significantly re-architected with Angular 2. There's a lot of brilliant things with Angular 1, but it's a first, second, third. I mean, the web moves fast. You could call Angular a first-generation HTML5 framework, or you could call it a fourth generation if you want to go back to, But it actually came out roughly around the same time as Backbone, 2009. So we've learned a lot. And as JavaScript's gotten faster and more powerful, and we've learned more about the browser and what the browser can handle, we can take different approaches to how we build out applications. And I'll talk a little more about that. There's also just, socially, culturally, there's a clean code revolution going on in the industry. And one of the reasons I think that is, jumping to my last point, is we've had 10 years of a stable paradigm building web applications in Ruby, in Python, in Java. And that's actually... I mean, there's been a lot of change, but if you look at, say, Java applications, there's not a significant change from 2000. I was working on a very large enterprise Java application in 2000. We were shifting to composition of objects. We were using JUnit had just come out. The Agile Manifesto had just been released. And, we were building large applications. And that's 15 years of working in a similar paradigm. Like, I talk to companies today, and they still have struts, and they still have, a lot of the same things that I worked with, Spring, Hibernate. I mean, they've all evolved. But, we've actually had a fairly stable period of development, and that's drastically changed how confident we can be in making a statement like technical debt is evil. We're not going to do it anymore. Stop the insanity. No more technical debt. And with that, we start thinking harder about state. We start thinking harder about application architecture. And we think a lot harder about how we build things and what we're willing to invest. And that's one of my points in actually looking at a functional approach and a functional reactive approach, is that, you know, if we are that committed to clean code, clean architecture, evolvable architectures, then it's a really good choice. And it's worth the investment. But it's going to be a painful shift for the industry, just like object-oriented was and just like web development was. Even Windows. I don't know how many people here learned Windows programming when Windows 3 came out. I'm going to date myself. I actually learned C++ from the first book on the market, and then I learned Java from the first book on the market. I learned Ruby from the first book on the market, and I learned Angular from the first book on the market. So either I'm really progressive or I just really like shiny new things. I'm not sure which one yet, but it's interesting seeing the evolution. Like early Windows programming books, they talked about the dilemma of people understanding event-based programming models. And to me, that's just unthinkable. We've only been doing event-based programming for a decade, and probably three-quarters of the people in the audience are staring at me like, what's he talking about? But the concept that you'd have an event fired at you from an operating system that you respond to for a mouse movement or a keyboard click, rather than writing your own sort of procedural loop that's, you know, checking to see if there's been a keystroke, that actually, like, ruined people's mental health. It was that disruptive to the industry. I mean, you'd buy a book on Windows programming, and there was like 30 pages on the event model. And if you would read that today, you'd want to just claw your eyes out. It would be so boring. But it was a significant cultural shift. So there are these big changes, object-oriented programming. There was tons of essays in 1990 about, you know, what percentage of enterprise programming teams could make the shift to object-oriented programming, and the talk about what kind of a programmer could do that. Bertrand Meyer wrote this article that sort of slagged C programmers, and James Martin got upset at him, and they had like a little war, and it was interesting. I mean, there's a lot of cultural considerations. The biggest thing that's really exciting about, like, all I hear about in terms of software architecture and clean code and good programming practices lately is, like, can you reason about your code? And that means, can you reason about your state? And those two principles, I think, are really helpful in cutting through the noise and trying to figure out what we should be doing and whether we should adopt an FRP-type approach. The other thing I think that's really driving this as well is continuous delivery, because it makes you honest. It makes you honest in your agile practice. If you're not doing a good agile process with small features that are completely done and you're trying to push things to production, you're going to crash and burn. And so continuous delivery makes us want to have more confidence in our code. It sort of gently nudges us towards a better sort of clean code practice with less technical debt. So all of these things are coming together to really drive the shift. And we've had, I guess, an amazing sort of opportunity, and it's sort of rare in the industry, with the JavaScript ecosystem allowing us to evolve incrementally. So instead of waiting for a Microsoft or an IBM or someone to spend 3 years developing a new programming suite and unleash it on the market, we have people inventing JavaScript libraries, throwing them out there, people laughing at them, and then 3 years later they're changing the industry, like React. A lot of people looked at React originally and they just couldn't get their heads around it. It didn't make sense. A virtual DOM, that's the only thing they heard, and that just sounded silly. But it's about the state and reasoning about state, and the virtual DOM actually turned out to be a great idea because the browser DOMs are so slow. And so all these little things, you know, Backbone, Ember, Angular, React, Mithril, Vue, all these frameworks are coming out. They're introducing new ideas. They're learning from each other, and they're driving an evolution. And they're allowing us to take smaller steps towards a functional approach. And we've taken a lot of those steps, and, it's really come up with some really interesting things, and we'll talk a little more about that. So the other big shifter, and I talked a little bit about this, in complex HTML5 applications, and I'll show you a diagram near the end that I don't really like anymore. But, you know, generally, you know, one of the questions is, are we building a CRUD application? Well, then it's not a big deal. We're going to use a REST API, and we're going to use two-way data binding in Angular. We're just going to push things back and forth, and it's easy, and you do your five-minute quick application. You work on it for a few days, and you're just going great, and you get a few more developers on the team, and then all of a sudden things start to slow down. All of a sudden, your tests don't really work anymore. You're finding it hard to write tests. And it's because there is no such thing anymore as a simple CRUD application. You have CRUD components. You have a piece of your application. Even if you're just updating a user record, you're going to have context. You're going to have a header. You're going to have some extra information, maybe the picture of the person on the right. Then you're going to have like a directory listing of people in the company, like if this was like a user directory for updating user information. So all of a sudden, you, what you thought was a simple CRUD application actually has, what do we have here, 6 different sort of regions that have synchronized state. There's very few applications that don't run into state issues over time. And when you have different developers working on it, it's not just about, you know, thinking about the whole state of the application, but actually having a shared ability to think about it. And that can be as much of a problem as well when different people take different approaches to state. Someone wants to push something, you know, to one area to maintain a global state or share state, or and other people want to do it a different way. And it becomes very hard to reason about an application. I'll just give a little anecdote about one project we had. We had 4 really super smart developers working on an application, and it was a fairly big mobile application. We were writing it with Angular, and they just ended up getting to this point where they just kept stepping on each other's toes. They were thinking about things slightly different. It was like a personality thing. We don't actually use technical leads at Wrangle. We believe strongly in agile practices and having a self-organizing team and getting everybody bought in. However, that does lead to issues where you can have a clash, a conflict, and you hope that your retrospectives and the emotional intelligence of your team gets you all to the same page, but sometimes you don't catch it early enough, and you end up with an application architecture that's a little rigid, and these developers are having pull requests, and we don't merge any pull requests without peer review, and they're basically having fights over pull requests. Like, this pull request is living 4 or 5 days, and you'd argue, well, you know, if you were talking before you actually wrote features and you were actually sharing information and working, you know, really truly as an agile sort of team, then you would have actually understood what everyone was doing, and you would have had, you know, a pull request that was easily merged. Then they looked at the application architecture and they just decided to refactor it. And they took an Angular, classic Angular application, and they put in a Flux architecture, and that gave them a common sort of state model to reason about and a way of communicating across components. It decoupled their work, and the team started cruising again. It was actually a fascinating sort of experience for them and for us. So there are no simple CRUD applications, I think, would be a way to look at it. We talked about clean code as being a issue, and I thought I'd just put up a blank slide because that's pretty clean, but it's the cleanest code you've ever seen. State oppression. So, state is what kills us in applications, and that is an insight that wasn't really clear, you know, 2 years ago. I mean, it was clean code and well-reasoned code and high cohesion, low coupling, but this actual concept of really just taking a view of the state of your application and reasoning about that, and, you know, then being able to work from that state and build application logic against it has been a really interesting and powerful shift. And so, can you reason about state? Can you maintain a state you can reason about? So those two things are essential. And that leads us to this concept of global application state, which we're going to talk a little bit more later. And someone was talking to me about this, and he loved global application state, and I made a slide, and I basically, you know, created an acronym, and I thought, that's not really going to fly. So global application state is probably not the term we want to use. So I started using client application state because it makes a better acronym, and I like acronyms. So client application state, like, you know, globals are evil. That's generally considered to be a truism. But now we're taking a React application or an Angular application, and we're pushing all the state to the top, and now we have a global application state, and we have state in one location. And that's an interesting sort of dilemma. And it's one that we talked about a lot and reasoned a lot about. And fundamentally, it ultimately is a good thing. And I'll talk a little bit about why that is. When you think about global application state, you're thinking and managing your application architecture. And if you don't, then your application's going to decay over time. Every new feature is going to corrupt your concept of what the application is and what it does. And so if you extract out a global application state that you can reason about and that you keep sort of clean and you keep updating, then what that gives you is an application architecture that doesn't devolve over time. And that's how you can think about it. Like, you have this application, you've built it, you have like a user model, and you're building features against that, and now you're adding certain things like task management for those users or training plans if it's an HR system. And, you know, what is that global application state? If you don't really think about it, somebody builds out the feature for managing training plans, they just extend the data model, they build their business logic, and they push it, a lot of code in there just to sort of fudge things and make everything work together. then someone else works on another feature, someone works on another feature, and the concept of what your application state is at one given time starts to devolve rapidly. Someone makes an update somewhere, it's mutating other things that other pieces of your code are depending upon, and now you've got an issue where anytime you try to make a change, even if you have perfect unit tests, you can have great unit tests that help protect you from corrupting a horrible architecture, which is a much better place to be than no unit tests, but it's still a massive problem. And so you can think of applications generally going through state decay over their life cycle. And so there's ease of extension now because you don't have to reason about state. You don't have to, you know, do these difficult problems, but there's increasing costs per feature in the future. And the best analogy we've come up for this, and this is going really sort of back in time and sort of old school, but it's really it's SQL, it's database modeling. It's actually trying to design an application. You're capturing the state in a database, and you're trying to do these entity relationship diagrams. You're trying to reason about state, how it evolves over time. If you have to sort of take a view of that state for a certain application need that doesn't fit your normal data model, you create views, and you sort of just keep extending out your application sort of schema. And with a shared global application state, it's a similar thing. But the good thing about forcing that up front and forcing the thinking about that is it helps maintain your application architecture. So instead of multiple application states that can sort of devolve and sort of vary independently, you're bringing together a global application state that you're sharing across your application. So why a global state? You force updates to the state model as the application evolves. You have to address that issue. Now, this is a very difficult thing to do. So this is almost like a circular sort of reference, but this drives a lot of functional sort of programming. And if you think about it, you have a global application state that's going to change as you're evolving your application. If you can't update your application to match those changes, then you're going to have a hard time making changes because things are going to break all the time. So you have to be able to reason about state. When you change something in your global application state, you rename a variable, add a variable, and refactor it, you need to be able to find every single place that that's being affected or mutated or worked with, and you've got to be able to update it. And you've got to be able to do that quickly by being thinking about it easily. And that's something that happens beautifully in a sort of React Flux type architecture. It's a little harder to do if you have multiple stores. How many people here have done any work with React? So a little less, but so, you know, in Flux, there's this concept of stores that sort of have state and you have multiple versions of it. That gets complex. There's another approach that's become popular recently that goes with the global application state. And so now with a functional programming approach, that enables the testing and the refactoring, and you reduce your technical debt run rate. And this is a concept that I've become quite excited about lately because we're working with Angular 1 clients who need to want to go to Angular 2, but they're still working on an Angular 1 code base. And the question to ask is not, should we move to Angular 2 now, because we can't, but what can we do now to impact our technical debt accumulation, you know, your technical debt run rate? And even just using a brand new application architecture, if you're not refactoring and if you're not updating your application state, you're going to run a certain amount of technical debt that's going to increase over time. If you're doing an Angular 1 application or an old school style, you know, maybe 60% of your code is just pure technical debt that you're going to have to rewrite. It might be higher. It might be 80%. So you can think of every $10 you're spending on your app, $8 is basically burning. But you're getting the market, and there's the opportunity cost. But, you know, is there things you can do so for your new development, so your net new development, that reduces your technical debt? So you're incurring less technical debt. So for every $10 you spend on software development, only $1 is going to waste, basically. And, you know, these are things I think that make a lot of sense to think about. What's your technical debt run rate? How much of your budget is going to technical debt? What's the net present value cost of this? You know, do the math and make decisions based upon that. And I think this helps now thinking about global application state, architectural integrity drives a lot of good reasoning for going with a functional approach. And once you've gone with the functional approach, then you're in a good place to go with the reactive approach. You know, functions, that's been that incremental sort of improvement in the JavaScript world. So we have JavaScript using it in a functional approach, you know, learning that it's actually a fairly powerful functional language, but it doesn't have immutability. So immutable JS has come onto the scene, and it allows you to do immutable data structures. There's a different philosophy of how you, you know, what should you make immutable? How should you make it immutable? How should you work with it over time? There's a lot to learn about immutable JS. That's where, again, like that learning curve is pretty high. There's React with the component architecture and immutability and the functional approach there. RxJS, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Redux. And Redux stands for reducing flux, and it's a really interesting story. How many people here have seen Redux or heard of Redux? So internally as a company, if you know, Rango, we were an Angular consultancy, full-stack JavaScript, Angular, Node, Mongo. We started doing React work. That's probably about 20 to 30% of our business now. But internally, our developers really think of themselves as, you know, we're like a Redux shop. That's sort of where it's going, and it's going pretty quickly, where Redux is the fundamental application architecture, and React and Angular are the view layer on top of that. And fundamentally, we write mostly JavaScript, and, you know, the framework is becoming less and less important over time. And then the other big shift is streams. RxJS, Bacon, Falcor, GraphQL, Meteor. But without the functional approach, you end up running into the same problems as you would have with early stage Angular projects. You can't reason about state. You've got too much mutation going on. We worked on a couple of large Meteor applications, and it was insane. You couldn't actually figure out what was going on. It was far too reactive with no control. If you have reactive, but you're maintaining state, and it's immutable, and you're controlling the mutation, and you can reason about the mutation, then reactive works extremely well. So this is the sort of tour of the shift in progress. I'm going to go through these a little bit quicker. And this was fundamentally originally an Angular or React question that we were trying to address for some of our clients. And this is the wrong question. The other question is REST API or streams. I think that's also a little premature. You want to address, you know, how you're handling state first and work back from there. If you've handled state well, then streams are awesome. Controllers are components, MVC or components. If you're going with a immutable global application state, then components make a lot more sense, and you can get a lot more sort of cohesion where you're just rolling everything into standalone components. So the concept of a controller sort of starts to go away and merges into the concept of a component. And in the React world, they've gone even a little bit crazier with that, and they've been talking about inline styles, taking us 10 years back with CSS that you're actually putting inline, because that allows you to have more isolation of your component. And it's actually, there's a really great talk from React Europe on that. I actually have the sticker. And Comic Sans. I don't know if you can see it. My style is inline. That was from the talk. Global application state. You know, what are we after? You know, ultimately, we want to tame complexity. Complexity of multiple people working together on the project. Complexity over time. And we have a complex single-page app. That's what I was talking about. Like, we're building different types of apps. That's the motivation. Everything's connected to everything else. Change anything, break something somewhere, and you can screw up your application in absolutely any framework. I've proven that many times myself. The best-known solutions as of 2015, the component-based UI. And our recommendation is, even if you are in a hardcore Angular team and you love Angular, which I do, it's an awesome framework, still go and learn React, because React just has some great ways of thinking about component architecture and composing applications. Think about state. Like, React has really taught the JavaScript industry to think hard about state and take a stateless approach deeper into the stack. And so React has the stateless approach at the top view layer. Like, people talk about React as being the V in MVC. That's not really true. It is everything in MVC. It's a different paradigm. And it has a stateless approach, though, at the DOM level. That can be pushed deeper into the stack, and that has some awesome ramifications. It's also easier to think about from a large application architecture perspective. So you have a component architecture. You have UI components. You build the UI layer of your application as a collection of those components. Helps with code reuse testing. Makes it easy to reason about your code. This is where it gets interesting, right? So you have state, and you have dependencies, and you have mutation of state. And this is where React gets really, really interesting. There's the concept of state and properties and the way you think about your application and how you compose your application. And this is where functions really start to play well, because immutability and transformation is key to having state you can reason about. So you have dumb components that are not aware of your app. You have smart components that hook into the rest of your app, and you have smartish components that are sort of in between. So here's a dumb component. You have a property change go in, you have property changes coming out, and you have events. You can drop them anywhere. there's nothing going on. Like they're completely, they're like functions. They're like pure functions. You have smart components. These are going to mutate state. So in the React world, they work with stores. They can work with your services in an Angular perspective. They're mutating state. Use them sparingly because they mutate. So if you can use mostly dumb components and you can use smart components sparingly, now if you think about this and you've done any kind of functional programming, we're talking about functional composition here. Functions have no side effects. Dumb components have no side effects. Smart components have side effects. So you're controlling where the side effects are and you're composing your application and you're getting reusable code. And so you have these smart components and these dumb components, and reasoning about that and learning the techniques of assembling them now gives you a very powerful arsenal for building complex UXs. And this is very functional. This is where the functional aspect of it comes into play. These components are functions and they're being composed. And you have smartish components that maybe have some mutation, they're kicking out events. Sometimes you do have to fudge things a little bit. But there's also another approach where, what happens quickly, even with a React application and a Flux architecture, people cheat. People mutate state, people break the rules, and now you no longer can actually reason about your application that well. So is there another way of doing that? Components, this is a little Angular React, isolated directives, they were never really loved. React brought components into the limelight, and they've really helped clarify our thinking about components. And React components are functional composition, hence the gateway into functional programming. But again, you do have components in Angular 1, so you can do all of this in Angular. Angular 2 is really putting them to the center. That's fundamentally what Angular 2 is bringing to the table. But now we're thinking about a stateless architecture, and we talked about that global application state. We've talked about functional composition with components. Stateless is good. Objects are bad. I mean, there's a great talk by Rich Hickey called Simple is Easy, or Easy is Simple, I forget which, but it's basically a very soft sell of closure. He doesn't mention closure, but he just destroys object-oriented programming. A little unfairly, but it's a great talk. A lot of us were raised on object-oriented programming. Objects are stateful. The effect of calling a method depends on the arguments in the object state. It's very painful to test. There's mutation happening on every single object. It's very hard to understand. It's very hard to reason about. And it aims to mimic the real world, but we're writing software. Why replicate the unnecessary complexity? I mean, most of the time we want to escape the real world. Now we're trying to mimic it, and we're suffering the same pain. That was a joke. The real world's awesome. Stateless is good. The alternative? Pure functions. The output of a pure function depends only on the inputs. Pure functions have no side effects. Pure functions have no state. They're much easier to understand. They're much easier to test. And they're very easy to build through composition. So this is where we're at in building a modern web application with components. The components are functions. You have a component that is not mutating anything, but they're actually components that are affecting your user interface. And it's been shown very effectively in the React community that this is an amazing sort of model that allows us to build large apps. And we're learning about this sort of global state and how to think about it. There's a great talk from React Rally in August where someone talks about Flux, and he throws up the Flux diagram, and he asks the audience, it's like, so here, who here understands this? And it's like, nobody raises their hands, and this is like the reference Flux architecture diagram. And he goes, I'm pretty sure you all do what I do. And he goes to the next step, and he basically crosses out everything he doesn't understand. And he goes, and this is what I use. And that was his definition of Flux. That's the same in most projects. Flux is a very abstract concept, and people use it however they want to use it, and stores become sort of multiplied, and it just becomes messy over time. React in the functional DOM, render method can be almost like a pure function. Render is the magic of React. The DOM is not manipulated, rather it's calculated from properties. So components have state, but its use must be limited and you can't modify it directly. This is attractive, though it requires some doublethink. In contrast, Angular components are stateful in the normal object-oriented style by default, but you can emulate React style. So again, this is where this is where the functional revolution is happening right now in the JavaScript world. And this is where, when we nail it on the front end with components and our ability to think functionally and manage state, now we can connect this to a reactive back end and really have some amazing things happen in our application. But going the other way is usually very hard. But what about your app's data? How state becomes really painful. You have a component, you have a model. Yay, and then you have another component, and another component, and another component, and another model, and another model, and another model. You can probably all guess what's going to happen here. Ooh, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh, the pain, oh my God. Okay, we got a bug that just took me 4 days to fix a bug because I had no idea what was going on in the app. That developer's left the team. We're actually having someone else look at the application. They're on day three, and they still don't know what's going on, and that's just, we don't want to be there. And good practices can solve a lot of this, but a good architecture can solve more of it. And good code reviews and things like that. So here's the Flux model. It's unidirectional data flow. And this is really interesting because the thing that really got me really excited about Angular was two-way data binding. And now two-way data binding has been shown to be a really horrible idea, which is really quite amazing. I mean, that's like 3 years. I mean, that's how fun JavaScript is. So now you have a component, you have a dispatcher, and that dispatcher, you have a mediator basically that's handling the flow of state through the application, and it's handling mutation. So again, it all boils down to mutation and state, and the components now can be pure functions or they can be sort of smarter functions that are dealing with the store and dealing with mutation. Oh, hit the wrong button. Sorry. All right. So now you're thinking, like, where's the mutation happening? You have actions, you have stores. I won't go into this. This is the general Flux architecture. But the main idea is you're controlling the flow of state, and you're controlling mutation, and your components now can be pure functions, and you can compose applications. But that whole right side gets pretty baffling, and can get pretty messy pretty quick, and you can have multiple stores, and, you know, a developer doesn't really want to work with the other developer, and they create their own store, and, yeah. So data is streams. So this is now the reactive side. You create a stream, you share the stream, you subscribe to the stream. Your components and stores are still stateful, but the inputs are better controlled. And so you have the stream, and you have the functions. You have some state. You know, but can we push this further? Misbehaving subscribers. Every subscriber gets a reference to the emitted object. So this is getting suspiciously like global variables again. But global variables are different than global state because global variables are just used and abused. Global state can be reasoned about, and that's the big difference. What if one of the receivers decides to modify it? We bring in immutables, immutable JS. Immutable data structures store data without introducing state. Object freeze is a shallow freeze. It doesn't go deep. Immutable JS allows you to be frozen all the way down. What happens when you want to modify your data? You have derived immutables. This is something immutable JS does. You can't change immutables, but you need to. You derive new ones. It's different in a specific way without altering the original. There's a lot of really cool stuff going on in immutable JS. You know, one of the questions, just as a heads up, with immutable JS is can it actually handle the memory requirements for doing this in a browser with a larger JavaScript application? And by all accounts, they've solved a lot of those problems, and it's actually doing a bang-up job of doing it. Immutable JS is the library to use at the moment. And it's a key building block for stateless architecture. Because if it's immutable, it's stateless. Because you can't mutate, and you're just pushing data through, and that's a pure function thing now that's happening with your components. Can we get more stateless? And that's where Redux comes into play. And the key concept is reducing actions. So there's a great talk by Dan Abramov from React Europe. Has anyone seen his talk? If there's one talk you watch this year, I highly recommend watching it. So Dan Abramov, he took 3 months off to work on this talk, and his initial starting point was to be developer workflow and have things refresh and do hot loading and really being able to have a cool developer workflow and sort of go back in time and replace state and not have to click through things again. And he was getting close to React Europe where he was going to present it, and he tweeted, it's like, oh my God, I've accidentally re-implemented Flux, right? He basically ended up starting with Flux and trying to make it, you know, a little more functional and trying to simplify and trying to tie it into his development workflow. And he ended up just breaking it and changing it. And so it's called Redux for reducing Flux, but it's not really Flux anymore. It's more about reducing actions and a functional approach. So action reducers basically take value in state and they transform it. And in Redux, your app state is a reduction over the history of actions. So you're actually now looking at actions, and you're managing them, and you're managing them in an immutable, trackable way. And as an example, this is a longer talk, but each reducer is a pure function. Reducers are independent of each other. History can be rolled back and replayed, and reducers can stay synchronous. And so what happens now is that you can actually replay activity, and you have some really amazing stuff going on in your application that you can reason about and control. And so this is pushing immutability down into the action layer. So you call an action creator to initiate a request. It emits an action to inform everyone a request was made. The action creator emits an action that it was completed or when it fails. And it pushes details of making a request into a module. So you have this action happening. And again, it's getting the data. And what you're doing now is you're able to use these pure functions to reduce what's going on in your state. And your state now is being pushed up to the top as a global application state that every time that something needs to be done, you're recomputing the application state using a tree of pure functions that you can reason about. And it simplifies where things are being mutated, and it simplifies what the top layer is. So that's Redux. It came out in middle of the year, and it's making massive inroads in the industry as a framework for managing functional programming and for managing state. And it really is a layer that goes below React and Angular and actually makes a lot of the debate of Angular or React somewhat moot. You build a Redux app and you sprinkle some Angular on top, you sprinkle some React on top, and it's really about components that are functional. So the question is, can I make the shift, right? So we talked a little bit about the benefits, or a lot about the benefits. We talked about functional composition, a little bit about reactive data streams. I think the big question, I talked a little bit before about this, so I'll hit this quickly, but there's been massive waves of disruption, and we forget about how hard it was to make the shift. Waterfall development, actually doing upfront design and sort of coding and testing and delivery, the move to Agile, which is still a huge struggle for most companies, especially larger ones. Object-oriented programming, the failed incursions of functional programming from academia, it's starting to happen because we've had those evolutionary baby steps. And we actually have a big problem we need to solve, and that's maintaining state in large web applications that are talking asynchronously to a backend. That is a new problem, it's a big problem, and that's driving a lot of the value that's driving the innovation and the shift. Ruby on Rails had huge issues with application architecture. Angular 1, the same thing, and React is having the same problems. And people were struggling with React, and Flux was originally just posted as hey, here's this crazy idea of how I think you should build a React application, and people were so hungry for it, it just immediately became a dominant application architecture. It was actually amazing. React was a slow adoption by comparison to Flux. The key aspects of the modern stack: components, predictable state containers, a move to global application state, reactive functional programming with global application state, and streams. Should I make the shift? Should my team make the shift? This was an early slide I don't really care for anymore, and I actually don't even agree with it anymore. I was thinking about application architecture. Do you have simple forms, complex forms? Are you doing dashboards, reporting? What's the size of the application? And then you can look, what's your team and how important it is to reason about your app? If you're building a small application, use Perl 5. Who cares? Use CGI. It's a small app. It doesn't really matter. Perl 6 is supposed to come out this year. And that's actually adding functional reactive programming. That's how influential this is. And I think earlier on I talked about it, there are no simple CRUD applications, especially in the single page application space. So forget that. To the early question, MVC or FRP, I would say that's not really the question either. It's functional or not first. If you can nail the functional, if you can go with the global application state, if you can bring these approaches in your application, you have a much more resilient architecture that you can maintain and evolve over time. If you can solve the functional aspect of things, then streams actually make a lot of sense. If you try to do streams first and build on top of it, you're probably going to build something really, really awful, and you're going to probably want to throw it out. And that's not a bad practice either. From the Mythical Man Month, one of the recommendations was prepare to throw one away to establish your application architecture. there's just, it's a big shift. But I think starting top down, start with components. If you're on an Angular project, learn a bit of React, learn a bit of the component architecture in Angular 2, shift over to that, get to the point where you have good immutable state, you can reason about state. Now you can start connecting your application to streams. Now you might have a different problem that's bigger, and reactive streams would just solve a lot of pain. That's a different case. So recommendation, start with functions, not streams. Embrace global application state. Redux, it's awesome. We've used it on like 4 or 5 projects now, and I went to every team, and it's like, okay, you know, what's wrong with it? Like, when's the other shoe going to drop? I mean, it's not as cool as it looks, right? And it's like, well, sort of it seems to be. We're not sure yet, but it's actually working extremely well. So Redux, not Flux. Components, not specific frameworks. And when I say components, when we're talking about a component architecture here, we're talking about functional composition. That's why React has taken off. It's a meaningful way of building large applications that you can reason about because it uses functional composition and it controls mutability of your state. Get your reference architecture. If you can get your reference architecture, you're probably not going to crash and burn. Be prepared to throw one away. Invest in getting your reference architecture. And I could go on and on about Java, Rails, Angular, horror stories, and scars. Get your reference architecture. I talked a little bit about that earlier. All new waves go through this. So there's value in getting to this kind of approach. And again, I don't, like, Angular's awesome, but the pain from Angular 1, large Angular 1 applications and maintaining state was pretty stunning. Unanswered questions, you know, learning to build with functional reactive programming. You know, what's it going to take for teams to shift? You know, functional reactive architecture decay with scale, a big team. I think this actually works better because you are forced to think about state and you're forced to maintain state. And I think architectural decay, state decay, happens insidiously otherwise. So elevating the discussion about state and managing it has a huge impact. So I think that's a win, but again, these are still things to be looked at. Architectural decay with new teams. You build a great application, you hand it over. What happens? How many ways are there to cheat? If someone doesn't understand the app, now, this is actually another great thing, because if you've actually built a true functional application architecture with immutability and you can reason about state, it's actually pretty clear when someone's breaking the rules. It sort of takes out your whole architecture. So you have a fail fast going on. Whereas if you're working with Flux and multiple stores and React, there's all kinds of little ways to cheat. If you go a few extra steps and you throw in immutable JS and you sort of go all in on that functional approach, there's the opportunity to fail fast, which is a good thing, and catch, you know, the decay. React and observables, since we stop worrying about that because we're actually really focused on Redux, so I don't care anymore, but it's an interesting thing. If you watch Sebastian from the Facebook core team try to answer that question, they've actually been looking at this, and it's an interesting problem.